I'm Terry Gross with the second half of our interview with Eric Clapton. Clapton is one of rock's virtuoso guitarists, one of the first guitar heroes, and guitar godfather to many of the heavy metal bands of the 70s and 80s. He has a new album called Journeyman. Last time on Fresh Air, Clapton talked about his early career in the British blues scene as a member of the Yardbirds and John Mayall's Blues Breakers. In the mid-60s, he was ready to soften his purist approach to the blues. He formed Cream with bassist and singer Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker. Cream did play some blues standards, but they also played a lot of original material and became known for their extended improvised solos. Here's one of those jams with Eric Clapton on guitar from a 1968 Cream recording of the Robert Johnson blues classic Crossroads. What was it like for you to learn to take sustained solos in concerts? Were you used to doing that before Cream?
Yes, I think we did it with... I think John would encourage me to play as long as I liked, but I had a much more controlled idea about what it should be then. With Cream, we found it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play and we would just play off the top of our heads, and it worked. A lot of the time it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times at Fillmore West when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I mean, I thought
okay.
It was fantastic.
My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records? On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimi was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theatre in London called the Savile Theatre where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimi play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really... listened to Jimmy properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed. And that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, it was the other way around from the way that you think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't add the riff to the song, we added the song to the riff.
Mm-hmm. And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer on.
Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
I'd had the Robert Johnson album for many years by then, and I was pretty well familiar with all of the songs on there, and I thought that was the best one. I mean, I always wanted to do Robert Johnson's songs in different... I mean, the first one I did was with John Mayall. I did Rambling on My Mind.
Which you sang also, yeah.
Yeah, but then with Cream, each time we made a record, I would find some way of arranging a Robert Johnson song to put on there. But mm-hmm. Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life, in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think.
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London, and it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with "Clapton is God" written on it in white chalk or paint. I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And as far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, I would just... I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times. Maybe it was in Rolling Stone. New York Times? Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film where we're stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house. I'm waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game, a musical game, for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what, I mean, I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really, we were selling the audiences short, you know. We were going on stage stoned, and we were playing just kind of meaningless, a lot of the time anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another. And then we talked to the manager about it, and he decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think... during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
you, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off. You know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed. You know, we were probably going to do in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums and we weren't ready. We had barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
Mm-hmm. You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs. Yeah, I can't remember where it started. I've always been I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another, an obsessive personality to say the least. And even when I was 16, it was like peer pressure. To everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life, it seemed to be, to get stoned. And I realized now that I was going to end up, you know, on the heap. And I pretty well got close to that. And during the early 70s, I got as close to killing myself with drugs as I could ever get. And it started out the way it always starts out, you know, smoking a joint or taking a few pills. And for some people, it escalates very quick. For me, it took a long time, but I got there, and I diced with death for a while, and I regret it. That's for sure.
Did you have like a bottoming out moment where you figured this is it? I've got to change.
Yeah, I think it's funny because it's difficult to be. I mean, when you're that stoned, it's difficult to be. To stand outside of yourself and see how far you've gone, you know, because you're so wrapped up in it. Other people can tell you, but it's very difficult for you to see yourself. And it happened to me at some point. I'd had friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my jailers, you know. They were making sure that I didn't harm myself. I was taking lots of heroin. I was taking Mandrax, which is a powerful, like a Quaalude equivalent. I was drinking lots of hard liquor. And at some point, I remember seeing myself, and this is true, sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it. And what I was doing, I was trying to escape from my own house where these people were trying to look after me. And thank God, one of the guys had taken out the rotor arm of the engine, and I was just sitting there trying to start the car, totally naked. I don't know where I was going to go, but I had a flash then that things had gone a little too far. So that was when I decided to kind of start doing something about it.
And what did you do?
I went to an acupuncturist who had set up a practice in London using a fairly revolutionary form of treatment whereby she passed a small electric current from one ear to the other and induced a sort of a mild natural narcosis, which took away the withdrawal symptoms which you get when you're trying to stop taking heroin.
Mm-hmm.
The point was, of course, that I hadn't actually used it. I'd never taken heroin intravenously, so it wasn't that hard a habit for me to kick. It was quite hard, but I did it with the help of this acupuncturist.
Did you ever think that an addiction to drugs, an obsession with drugs, is kind of related to, in a way, the same kind of obsession that allows you to spend as many hours as you must have developing your guitar playing? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive about guitar playing and about your music.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I like to think of my guitar, my love for guitar playing, as being dedicated. But it's not far removed from being obsessive. I mean, there's a fine line between those two words. And What happened when I became obsessed with drug taking was that obviously my guitar playing took second place. And, you know, one is a natural kind of dedication and the other one is a very unnatural dedication.
For a while after you gave up heroin, I know you had some alcohol problems for a while. I was wondering if you ever had any reservations about doing a Michelob beer commercial, having been an alcoholic.
Well, I think I would think twice about it now. I'm not saying that I wouldn't do it because... I like advertising, actually. I mean, I'm a fan.
Watching it on TV, like the jingles, or
whatever. Yeah, I'm not so crazy about this country's, but I love English advertising and European advertising in general is a very high caliber, and a lot of American advertising too. And so, if it's done well, I like to get involved in somewhere. And I tell you, the funny thing is that I've just kind of. Just remembered about that Michelob thing was that at the time I needed some exposure. You know, I really did. It was actually possible for me to wander around and people not even know who they knew that Eric Clapton was a guitar player. They didn't know what he looked like. You know, that's the truth. And they didn't. They'd never seen him on TV. I'd only done maybe one or two TV shows in my life. Been involved in a cameo performance in The Last Waltz or something like that. So. It occurred to me to be a good vehicle if I was going to be more accessible and to sell more records or whatever, sell more tickets at concerts, to do something like that. And that was the perfect vehicle for it.
Was it effective for that?
For that, yes, it was. It was. People began to recognize me on the street, which is something I'm in two minds about. I like it and I don't like it, but... It was something, I mean, I have to tip my hat to Phil here. He actually said, look, man, you've got to do it because people don't know what you look like.
To Phil Collins?
People want to know. They want to know what you're like and show them,
So did the commercial help to sell records too?
I think so, yeah, uh-huh. I think so. It's certainly, I think it was instrumental in breaking me with a wider public all over.
Mm-hmm. Eric Clapton is my guest, and he has a new record, and the new record is called Journeyman. I want to ask you something about your past, about your very beginnings, actually. I know you've talked about this, that your mother had you, she wasn't married, and she left, I think, shortly after you were born, and you were brought up by your grandparents, who told you that they were actually your parents, and when your mother returned, you were told at first that she was your sister. And I'm wondering what effects you think that had on your public identity. Do you know what I mean? On your public sense of self.
It's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, whatever the result was, has to be a complicated result, isn't it, when you think about it? I've got so many different sides of my nature as a result of that that upbringing. I mean, I think there's a side of me that, dreads rejection, dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude and... I don't know. It's had all kinds of effects on me, most of which I've kind of started to deal with over the last few years and come to terms with. And if I can, I change parts of my personality that cause me difficulty, or I at least accept them. But for sure, it was an unusual upbringing,
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is, and we're great pals. We're more like brother and sister than anything else because she's, she's not that much older than me because she was, when I was born, she was 15. And so really the age difference isn't that much. And because we didn't spend time as mother and son when I was young, we're family members, but it's almost difficult to say what kind of family members we are.
Do you call her mom?
Yeah, I do. I call her Ma, but then sometimes I call her Pat too, which is her name. And it's a funny situation. It's a very loving situation, and it's finally come full circle to where everyone is kind of relaxed about it now.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, I know you converted to Christianity several years ago. Are you still a Christian?
Oh, I've always been a Christian. I mean, I was raised in England in what we call Church of England, C of E, and that's... That's really just basic. I think it's like Protestant, really. And I went to Sunday school and I went to church quite a lot. And I just stopped going when I started, hitting the road as a kid, as a teenager. Really, I had a kind of, I think you could call it a pseudo-religious experience in the early 70s. But it was all tied up with drugs and everything, so I don't take it so seriously now. But I pray, and I believe in a God of my understanding that kind of works when I work for it, you know. And I don't shove it down anyone's throat, and I don't talk about it very much, but I do have a kind of belief system that works more or less on a kind of karma basis, you know, that if I do well, things will go well, that sort of thing.
Tell me a little bit about putting together your new record. Different tracks have different guest artists on it. Some of the songs are old songs by Ray Charles or Muddy Waters. Some of them are new songs co-written by you or written by friends.
Well, bearing in mind that the Crossroads box set did well, and that seemed to be such a kind of a random look at my musical career, it spurred me to just go into the studio and do what I felt like doing, you know, and literally going one day at a time, making it up as we went along. So I almost left my mind a blank until I went into the studio. And the first thing that I wanted to do was do Hard Times, the Ray Charles song, and then just see what happened. And we had a lot of songs being sent to us. I had written some songs, which weren't very good, to be honest. And there were some covers that I wanted to do, but it all just seemed to be like a blank page to me, and we filled it in day by day.
Well, Eric Clapton, we're out of time. I regret it. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Great talking to you.